Today on Vox Talks Economics, what's the future of globalization? For the 65th and the last time for 2025, welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. We hope you've enjoyed the episodes that we've brought you in 2025 in our award-winning podcast. So remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts because, well, I know what's coming in 2026 and you don't want to miss an episode. At the beginning of next year, we are going to be bringing you the interviews that we recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. To whet your appetite for that, here's a conversation I had in Paris with Adam Posen, president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics, a distinguished fellow of CEPR, and a global authority on geopolitics and trade. When we met, we discussed how profound the changes in the multilateral order have been in 2025, how countries will adjust to this new normal, and whether the changes we have seen will ever be unwound. Adam, welcome. Delighted to have you.
Glad to be with you, Tim, and CEPR.
Now that the US has retreated from its role in post-war multilateralism, does that also mean that those public goods, that stable financial system, that rules-based order for dispute resolution, does that go away as well?
It goes away a lot. As I argued in a piece in Foreign Affairs recently called The New Economic Geography, the U.S. public goods, as you call them, Tim, was basically providing a lot of insurance to businesses, to foreign governments, to investors, to households even. And it was in the form of Navy vessels that meant you didn't think twice about shipping goods. It was dispute settlement and support for international institutions that managed disputes. It was the treasury market being deep and liquid that you could get in and out of U.S. treasuries essentially no matter who you were without an issue. It was quite literally the ability to access U.S. markets and other markets without political threat. And all of that is much less sure than it once was. And it varies from issue area to issue area, but companies, investors, governments all have to self-insure in a way they used to. And so for investors, that means literally buying hedges on dollar investments that they didn't used to. For trading partners, that means rethinking, just as the U.S. is rethinking alternatives to China for certain key supplies, other countries, other companies are rethinking sources for U.S.-based supplies. And this all costs money. Insurance isn't cheap. You have to either build in redundancy or stockpile or get substitutes. But that's not the end of the game. There's a lot that the European Union can do and European businesses and European thought leaders can do to make the world a better place than it would be. Take the U.S. backing off as given, but there's a lot of range of what the outcomes might be depending on how proactive Europe is, how open and inclusive Europe is versus how much Europe goes into a defensive crouch or worse, decides they're going to try to be like China or the U.S. That, I think, would be a mistake.
But in the short term, on the path to that, for now, then many places are thinking about what are safe jurisdictions.
Right.
Friendshoring, nearshoring. And that means in the short term, a reduction in the efficiency of trade. It means raised costs of doing business.
Absolutely. I just don't want people to focus solely on trade. There are all these other dimensions that are at least as important. I don't want people to overestimate the amount of damage being done. It's big, but it's not everything. And I also don't want people to underestimate the ability of large parts of the world economy to recover. I agree. This is going to be costlier than it used to be. It's a less nice world economy for everyone, but particularly for Europe, than it was from basically the late 80s until the mid-20-teens. I mean, that's just reality. But that's not the same as everything's gone, globalization's gone, the costs are unmanageable. It's reality.
But during that time, then we had the luxury of saying we can align economically. We don't have to pay too much attention to the political stance of many countries that we do business with. Now we're realigning politically.
That remains to be seen. I think one of the aspects of what I call the new economic geography is the irony of alliances, that the economies and countries that are most tied to the U.S. in both economic and security terms are the ones, in a sense, who are getting most badly treated. You look at Korea or Japan, but you also look at the U.K. temporarily because Trump likes the U.K. for whatever reason, is getting a slightly better deal. But Canada and Mexico are certainly not getting a good deal. And Europe's not getting as bad a deal, but not a great deal by any means. Whereas China and Russia, and this has been very clear with the recent announcements of the U.S. National Security Strategy, as it's called, but with other things the Trump administration has been pursuing along multiple paths, they're getting much more of a realist accommodation. And so, no, I don't think it's the politics determine things, or rather it's determined in the way what people usually think of when they think of politics now. And additionally, in a world where markets are harder to come by, but also particularly critical inputs are harder to come by in the sense of being less dependable, less reliable sourcing, there are a lot of countries and a lot of companies making a lot of nasty deals with pretty nasty regimes. And we shouldn't blind ourselves. I mean, there are a lot of European companies that made a lot of nasty deals with Russia and China.
Yeah.
So again, I agree, sound like an economist. The intercept has moved. There's been a level shift up in the cost or a level shift down in the standards in terms of political hypocrisy to go with economics, and it's meaningful, but it's not absolute transformation.
One of the functions of this rules-based order, the World Trade Organization was an example of that, was to say, well, everyone gets the same deal. Mm-hmm. Now we have a much more power-based way of deal making. Does that mean that smaller, less powerful countries will get pushed around a bit?
Yes, that I agree with. Sadly, I'm very sad to say I agree with, but I do think this is an economic regime that is going to be much harsher for most low middle income economies. I think the very largest G20 emerging markets, the India, Indonesia, Brazil, Mexico, Turkey, they're going to be fine. And if anything, they may do better, all else equal, you know, controlling for them Turkey's own self-destructive economics, for example. But they will do better in terms of how they're treated by others. And in fact, I think capital flows are already going disproportionately into them, both portfolio flows and foreign direct investment, because that bundle of security and economics that companies, investors, governments, they decide I can deal with Modi or Erdogan or Lula.
You have already seen them making some stand on that.
Absolutely. And they also, as a matter of realpolitik and economics, have more standing to stand up to the U.S. or China. But for everybody else, for the smaller economies, and particularly for the less high-income economies and the ones exposed to climate change and the ones who have natural resources somebody really wants, but we all know that that doesn't generally lead to benefits for the people at large and or ongoing development, this is bad. And you mentioned the multilateral regime, and I'd be less concerned with the formalities of multilateralism, but more with whether it's the World Trade Organization, as you mentioned, or the IMF or the World Bank, actually providing useful services and providing best practices and at least calling attention when a country or an economy is being exploited and giving some form of complaint or redress. And I think a lot of that is being eroded. And then finally, and this is one of the places where I think the U.S. was, at least under Biden, did a lot of things I didn't like, but in this front was trying to do the right thing in terms of pushing back against Chinese lending policies and some other countries' lending policies, including India. And as the IMF and the World Bank have pointed out, there's an awful lot of debt post-COVID a lot of countries have, and there should be some kind of restructuring or rethinking or something. And now the Trump administration is no longer even pushing the Chinese on that and is not using the international organizations with conviction. And so the prospects for getting that improvement are even worse.
The Peterson Institute has been raising the alarm about the risks of the collapse of the multilateral system for many years. Chad Bown, who is Adam's colleague at the Peterson Institute, is a longtime friend of Vox Talks, and way back in May 2019, we spoke to Chad for our episode, The End of the WTO, in which he correctly warned that the WTO's dispute resolution system might be one of the biggest casualties of President Trump's first trade war with China. When you follow Vox Talks Economics, you can find this and all our other episodes featuring Chad in the archives.
So we talk a lot at the moment about how this system is now devolving into regional hubs. Are there some that you would pick out as successful, not as stopgaps, as a progress towards a new multilateral system, world system, but ones that really seem to be making progress in their own right and defining their existence as more than a second best?
I think everything's going to be a second best, but there's a very wide range of second bests that are extremely useful and second bests that are a best second best.
Right, yeah. Right.
I think there are some areas, but I just want to initially push back a bit on the premise. My view is, and what I've tried to argue, is to some degree, it's still all to play for.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the post-American world economy has been visible as an emerging danger since the first Trump administration or even the end of the Obama administration, but it hasn't yet congealed or coalesced or solidified in ways. I think what we're seeing, and this goes to discussions people have in the forecasting business or the markets business about why haven't we seen the impact of the Trump tariffs or the anti-migration policy or things like that yet. And my view, and a lot of my colleagues at Peterson Institute view, is it's en route and it's too soon. There was a lot of uncertainty, and these are very hard choices to make, and there's a lot of cognitive dissonance of people not wanting to believe the world has changed. But I think the world has changed. And so we will see these regional hubs, getting back to your very valid question, Tim, become clearer over the next 1 to 5 years. And even if the Trump administration is turned out of office and there's some reversal, I think you will not go anything like all the way back to pre-Trump, pre-Biden. And so Europe has within its agency to do a lot to make it an attractive hub and a key contributor. ASEAN and ASEAN overlapping with the CPTPP countries have a chance to really make a difference. Those two are very important economically and geopolitically. There are others we can think of. Obviously, the Gulf states and Saudi are mm-hmm. playing a much bigger role in not only global finance, but in diplomacy and international economic organizations than they once did. So there's a lot of room. And if you think that the U.S. is absenting itself from past leadership roles or having a lot of influence on who got leadership roles mm-hmm. in the past, that was part of the self-interested benefits the U.S. got as chairman of the club while providing these public goods. But anyway, if we assume, I think rightly, that the U.S., partly willingly, partly not, is just not going to be in those roles, then there's a lot of space out there for others to step up, and some of it will be advantageous.
One thing the U.S. is not absenting itself from is industrial policy, in particular export controls. Are we locked into an industrial policy export control arms race here where there's just more and more piled on?
I think, Tim, the invoking of the image of the arms race is quite valid, particularly between the U.S. and China.
Yeah.
But I also think Europe doesn't have to play that game. And if Europe chooses to play that game, it'll just lose.
What's the alternative then?
The alternative is you don't put on export controls. Yeah. And you use much less tariffs, and your industrial policy is much more about the industrial policies that we have evidence from East Asia and the past in the US and Europe that work, which are about shutting down declining industries, helping workers adjust, investing in R&D, investing in general technologies, investing in infrastructure, but not spending a lot of time and effort using trade distortions and subsidies to create individual winner companies that then become too big to fail, too political to fail, and cost your own people a lot of money.
Do you have a concern that Europe might be going in the wrong direction?
Yeah, I think it's in debate right now. And there are various governments and various thinkers who are arguing, I think, much too knee-jerk, that reflexively, that if the US and China are doing this, Europe has to keep up. Whereas, A, just because the US and China do it doesn't mean it's right, in the sense of even self-serving. And B, just because the US and China do it doesn't mean that Europe's attempts to keep up will work. I think it fails on both those grounds. You can think about what are the specific industries that you absolutely need to have some domestic supply capacity in. What are the specific goods or inputs that currently Europe both needs and doesn't have an alternative to a Chinese or a US or some other concentrated source? And that gets you a limited number of things to do, which means that the burden on the economy is both worth it and not too distortionary. And if the US follows Chinese state-owned enterprises, with the Trump administration of all people now taking ownership stakes in particular companies and industries,
yes,
this is just going to blow through a lot of money and not achieve the goals. No matter how popular it becomes, it's still wrong.
What might happen to the global financial system? Could that fragment as well? And what would be the problem if that does happen?
That, to me, is actually in some ways much higher stakes than the trade stuff, because the trade, in the end, it's mostly easily substitutable things or relatively substitutable things. And over time, the economies adjust. If you have a dysfunctional, fragmented financial system, then you have a number of issues. But the biggest two are, first, you have inherently less diversification and less availability of savings to fund fiscal deficits and to fund investment in any given place, because you're putting up political and regulatory barriers. So the so-called savings glut flowing from China and Asia into the US goes down, and the money will not be perfectly transshipped through someplace else, because the whole point is to create these barriers. And that raises the cost of capital in US and Europe, and it reduces, for average people as well as financial intermediaries, their diversification, which is not good. In China, it probably has the opposite effect. It reduces diversification, which is even worse in China, but it probably further drives down returns on capital because you're trapping more capital at home. That's one set of big issues. It's very bad. But the other set of big issues is, we know when you create relatively uneven regulations and supervisory principles across the major financial systems, you increase the chances of financial crisis, because you get arbitrage around these and cliff edge distortions and financial firms that are exposed and then don't have the proper capital or liquidity coverage. Here, the Trump administration and the US are definitely to blame, as opposed to some of the other things we've talked about, where I see the world as scary and unfortunate, but salvageable. Here's where I start to get really scared. I think what the Trump administration is advocating on crypto, on stable coins, their general anti-regulatory stance, not just to say readjust the amount of the stress test burden on companies or allow more bank mergers, but to fundamentally reduce the capacity of the US bureaucracy to engage in technocratic financial supervision, to make their own calls apolitically, to engage in cooperation and information sharing with their international counterparts, to participate in things like the Basel III Endgame. All of these things are asking for trouble. Of all the things going on, in terms of something that could do first-order macroeconomic harm and further delegitimize stable democratic political economy, this fragmentation of the financial system is near the top for me.
There are some other issues which require multilateralism. Health requires multilateralism. We had a pandemic. Climate change requires multilateralism for obvious reasons. Can that be done on a regional basis?
I agree that the world would be a much better place for future generations and for the well-being of human beings if we had multilateral cooperation in both those areas, climate and health. But I actually think they're somewhat different. Mm-hmm. In health, as was demonstrated during the COVID pandemic, you cannot fully insulate any one society or economy from anybody else. There is this externalities, spillovers, however bloodlessly you want to call it. It's a pandemic. It goes across. Then again, here I particularly call out the Trump administration, the way they're dismantling standards of science and health domestically, and then having that deliberately as well as indirectly feed into lack of cooperation and participation in multilateral health initiatives and vaccines and warnings and tracking is just straight up going to kill people, and it's wrong. The climate is different. It's not that I don't think it's wrong and going to kill people that the Trump administration is in contradiction of all evidence to reduce climate change risks or ameliorate climate change risks. It will kill people and it is wrong. But what you were raising, Tim, about the separability of regions, I think, is much more possible in the climate sphere than in the health sphere. We can have a world where Europe is leading the way in terms of green tech, changing its energy mix, setting standards, showing voluntary change amidst all the awful stuff since Ukraine was invaded by Russia pretty barbarically and the energy supplies got cut off. There's been an enormous further move in Europe, as you and colleagues at CPR have written about, towards much greener energy mix, much more efficiency, much more electrification. And this counts towards stopping climate change or ameliorating climate change or inducing other governments to behave or to have best practices, including China, whether or not the U.S. participates. It's better if the U.S. doesn't free ride. It's better if we can put pressure on. But it doesn't prevent those kinds of measures. As many people as possible, you get involved. As many countries and economies as possible, you get involved. The better it is, and the more you're able to influence others, including the U.S. In the health sphere, that's true, but it's a much, much shallower gradient. If you don't get everybody involved, it is going to, in the end, catch you out.
How much of the change that we've seen recently do you worry is permanent and unfixable? How much do you think that enlightened self-interest will help to put back the good parts of this multilateral order?
I fully believe, Tim, that enlightened self-interest will lead to the resurrection of some of this, and that the U.S., whether it's in 2 years or 12 years, I don't know, will eventually come back. But I think there is a persistent impact of the need to self-insure and the distrust that is created. The longer this goes on, the more that will unravel and become self-fulfilling. Even if there's high inflation or other problems in the U.S. that lead to some return to normalcy, it's not going to do it overnight. The analogy is going to be in economic terms to Germany and Japan after the war, that the U.S. has to actively invest in institutions and rebuild trust.
Adam Posen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
The article Adam mentioned was published in Foreign Affairs in the September-October 2025 edition and is called The New Economic Geography.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Enjoy the holiday. We will be back soon. And if you're taking time off, check out some of the 64 other episodes from 2025. There is a lot to enjoy.